8. In Magus, as in every other barony of Midworld, the week before a fair day was a political week. Important people came in from the farther corners of the barony, and there were a good many conversationals leading up to the main conversational on reaping day. Susan was expected to be present at these, mostly as a decorative testimony to the mayor's continuing puissance. Olive was also present, and in a cruelly comic dumb show that only the women truly appreciated, they sat on either side of the aging cockatoo, Susan pouring the coffee, Olive passing the cake, both of them gracefully accepting compliments on food and drink they'd had no hand in preparing. Susan found it almost impossible to look at Olive's smiling, unhappy face. Her husband would never lie with Pat Delgado's daughter, but Cy Thorin didn't know that, and Susan couldn't tell her. She had only to glimpse the mayor's wife from the corner of her eye to remember what Roland had said that day on the drop. "For a moment I thought she was my mother." But that was the problem, wasn't it? Olive Thorin was nobody's mother. That was what had opened the door to this horrible situation in the first place. There had been something much on Susan's mind to do, but with the round of activities at Mayor's house, it was but 3 days to reaping before she got the chance. Finally, following this latest conversational, she was able to slip out of pink dress with appliqué, how she hated it, how she hated them all, and jump back into jeans, a plain riding shirt, and a ranch coat. There was no time to braid her hair, as she was expected back for Mayor's tea, but Maria tied it back for her, and off she had gone to the house she would shortly be leaving forever. Her business was in the back room of the stable, the room her father had used as an office, but she went into the house first and heard what she'd hoped to hear, her aunt's ladylike, whistling snores. Lovely. Susan got a slice of bread and honey and took it out to the barn stable, protecting it as best she could from the clouds of dust that blew across the yard and the wind her aunt's stuffy guy rattled on his post in the garden. She ducked into the sweet-smelling shadows of the barn. Pylon and Felicia nickered hello, and she divided what she hadn't eaten between them. They seemed pleased enough to get it. She made especially of Felicia, whom she would soon be leaving behind. She had avoided the little office since her father died, afraid of exactly the sort of pang that struck her when she lifted the latch and went in. The narrow windows were now covered with cobwebs, but they still let in autumn's bright light, more than enough for her to be able to see the pipe in the ashtray, the red one, his favorite, the one he called his thinking pipe, and a bit of tack laid over the back of his desk chair. He had probably been mending it by gaslight, had put it by, thinking to finish the next day. Then the snake had done its dance under Foam's hoofs, and there had never been a next day. Not for Pat Delgado.
"Oh, Dad," she said in a small and broken voice, "how I do miss thee."
She crossed to the desk and ran her fingers along its surface, leaving trails of dust. She sat down in his chair, listened to it creak under her as it had always creaked under him, and that pushed her over the edge. For the next 5 minutes she sat there and wept, screwing her fists into her eyes as she had as a wee shim. Only now, of course, there was no big Pat to come upon her and jolly her out of it, taking her on his lap and kissing her in that sensitive place under her chin, especially sensitive to the bristles on his upper lip it had been, until her tears turned to giggles. Time was a face on the water, and this time it was the face of her father. At last her tears tapered to sniffles. She opened the desk drawers, one after another, finding more pipes, many rendered useless by his constant stem-chewing, a hat, one of her own dolls — it had a broken arm Pat had apparently never gotten around to putting right — quill pens, a little flask, empty but with a faint smell of whiskey still present around its neck. The only item of interest was in the bottom drawer, a pair of spurs. One still had its star rowel, but the other had been broken off. These were, she was almost positive, the spurs he had been wearing on the day he died. "If my dad was here," she had begun that day on the drop, "but he's not," Roland had said. "He's dead." A pair of spurs, a broken-off rowel. She bounced them in her hand.
in her mind's eye seeing ocean foam rear, spilling her father, one spur catches in a stirrup, the row breaks free, then stumbling sideways and falling atop him. She saw this clearly, but she didn't see the snake Fran Lengel had told them about. That she didn't see at all. She put the spurs back where she had found them, got up, and looked at the shelf to the right of the desk, handy to Pat Delgado's smart hand. Here was a line of leather-bound ledgers, a priceless trove of books in a society that had forgotten how to make paper. Her father had been the man in charge of the barony's horse for almost 30 years, and here were his stock-line books to prove it. Susan took down the last one and began to page through it. This time she almost welcomed the pang that struck her as she saw her father's familiar hand, the labored script, the steep and somehow more confident numbers. Born of Henrietta, 2 foals, both well. Stillborn of Delia, a roan, mutant. Born of Yolanda, a thoroughbred, a good male colt. And following each, the date. So neat he had been, so thorough, so... She stopped suddenly, aware that she had found what she was looking for, even without any clear knowledge of what she was doing in here. The last dozen pages of her dad's final stockline book had been torn out. Who had done it? Not her father. A largely self-taught man, he revered paper the way some people revered gods or gold. And why had it been done? That she thought she knew. Horses, of courses. There were too many on the drop, and the ranchers, Lengel, Croydon, Renfrew, were lying about the threaded quality of the stock line. So was Henry Wertner, the man who had succeeded to her father's job. If my dad was here, but he's not, he's dead. She had told Roland she couldn't believe Fran Lengel would lie about her father's death. But she could believe it now. God's help her. She could believe it now.
What are you doing in here?
She gave a little scream, dropped the book, and whirled around. Cordelia stood there in one of her rusty black dresses. The top 3 buttons were undone, and Susan could see her aunt's collarbones sticking out above the plain white cotton of her shift. It was only on seeing those protruding bones that Susan realized how much weight Aunt Cord had lost over the last 3 months or so. She could see the red imprint of the pillow on her aunt's left cheek like the mark of a slap. Her eyes glittered from dark, bruised-looking hollows of flesh.
"Aunt Cord, you startled me. What are you doing in here?"
Aunt Cord repeated. Susan bent and picked up the book.
"I came to remember my father," she said, and put the book back on the shelf. Who had torn those pages out? Lengel? Reimer?
She doubted it. She thought it more likely that the woman standing before her right now had done it. Perhaps for as little as a single piece of red gold.
"Nothing asked, nothing told, so all is well," she would have thought,
popping the coin into her money box, after first biting its edge to make sure it was true.
"Remember him. It's ask his forgiveness ye should do, for ye've forgotten his face, so ye have. Most grievous have ye forgotten it, Sue."
Susan only looked at her.
"Have ye been with him today?"
Cordelia asked, in a brittle, laughing voice. Her hand went to the red pillow mark on her cheek and began rubbing it. She had been getting bad by degrees, Susan realized, but it had become ever so much worse since the gossip about Jonas and Coral Thorin had started.
"Have ye been with Cy Dearborn? Is your crack still dewy from his spend? Here, let me see for myself."
Her aunt glided forward, spectral in her black dress, her bodice open, her slippered feet peeping, and Susan pushed her back. In her fright and disgust, she pushed hard. Cordelia struck the wall beside the cobwebbed window.
"Ye should ask forgiveness yourself," Susan said, "to speak to his daughter so in this place. In this place."
She let her eyes turn to the shelf of ledgers, then returned to her aunt. The look of frightened calculation she saw on Cordelia Delgado's face told her all she wanted or needed to know. She hadn't been a party to her brother's murder, that Susan could not believe. But she had known something of it.
"Yes, something." "Ye faithless bitch,"
Cordelia whispered.
"No," Susan said. "I have been true." and so she realized she had been. A great weight seemed to slip off her shoulders at the thought. She walked to the door of the office and turned back to her aunt. "I've slept my last night here," she said. "I'll not listen to more such as this, nor look at ye as ye are now. It hurts my heart, and steals the love I've kept for you since I was little, when ye did the best ye could to be my ma."
Cordelia clapped her hands over her face as if looking at Susan hurt her.
"Get out, then!" she screamed. "Go back to Seafront or wherever it is thee rolls with that boy. If I never see that trollop's face again, I'll count my life good."
Susan led Pylon from the stable. When she got him into the yard, she was sobbing almost too hard to mount up. Yet mount she did, and she couldn't deny that there was relief in her heart as well as sorrow. When she turned onto the high street and booted Pylon into a gallop, she didn't look back. 9. In a dark hour of the following morning, Olive Thorin crept from the room where she now slept to the one she had shared for almost 40 years with her husband. The floor was cold under her bare feet, and she was shivering by the time she reached the bed. But the chilly floor wasn't the only reason she was shivering. She slid in beside the gaunt, snoring man in the nightcap, and when he turned away from her, his knees and back crackling loudly as he did, she pressed against him and hugged him tightly. There was no passion in this, but only a need to share a bit of his warmth. His chest, narrow but almost as well known to her as her own plump one, rose and fell under her hands, and she began to quiet a little. He stirred, and she thought for a moment he would wake and find her sharing his bed for the first time in God's knew how long.
"Yes, wake," she thought. "Do."
She didn't dare wake him of her own. All her courage had been exhausted just getting here, creeping through the dark, following one of the worst dreams she had ever had in her life. But if he woke, she would take it as a sign and tell him she had dreamed of a vast bird, a cruel, golden-eyed rock that flew above the barony on wings that dripped blood.
"Wherever its shadow fell, there was blood," she would tell him, "and its shadow fell everywhere. The barony ran with it, from Hambry all the way out to Eyebolt, and I smelled big fire in the wind. I ran to tell you, and you were dead in your study, sitting by the hearth with your eyes gouged out and a skull in your lap."
But instead of waking, in his sleep he took her hand, as he had used to do before he'd begun to look at the young girls, even the serving wenches, when they passed, and Olive decided she would only lie here and be still and let him hold her hand. Let it be like the old days for a bit, when everything had been right between them. She slept a little herself. When she woke, dawn's first gray light was creeping in through the windows. He had dropped her hand, had in fact scooted away from her entirely to his edge of the bed. It wouldn't do for him to wake and find her there, she decided, and the urgency of her nightmare was gone. She turned back the covers, swung her feet out, then looked at him once more. His nightcap had come askew. She put it right, her hands smoothing the cloth and the bony brow beneath. He stirred again. Olive waited until he had quieted, then got up. She slipped back to her own room like a phantom. 10. The Midway booths opened in Greenheart 2 days before Reaping Fair, and the first folks came to try their luck at the spinning wheel and the bottle toss and the basket ring. There was also a pony train, a cart filled with laughing children pulled along a figure eight of narrow-gauge rails.
"Was the pony named Charlie?"
Eddie Dean asked Roland.
"I think not," Roland said. "We have a rather unpleasant word that sounds like that in the high speech."
"What word?" Jake asked.
"The one," said the gunslinger, "that means death."
Roy DePape stood watching the pony plod its appointed rounds for a couple of turns, remembering with some nostalgia his own rides in such a cart as a child. Of course, most of his had been stolen. When he had looked his fill, DePape sauntered on down to the sheriff's office and went in. Herc Avery, Dave, and Frank Claypool were cleaning an odd and fantastical assortment of guns. Avery nodded at DePape and went back to what he was doing. There was something strange about the man, and after a moment or two, DePape realized what it was. The sheriff wasn't eating. It was the first time he'd ever come in here that the sheriff didn't have a plate of grub close at hand.
"All ready for tomorrow?" DePape asked.
Avery gave him a half-irritated, half-smiling look.
"What the hell kind of question is that?" "One that Jonah sent me to ask," DePape said.
And at that, Avery's queer, nervy smile faltered a little.
"We're ready."
Avery swept a meaty arm over the guns.
"Don't you see we are?"
DePape could have quoted the old saying about how the proof of the pudding was in the eating, but what was the point? Things would work out if the three boys were as fooled as Jonas thought they were. If they weren't fooled, they would likely carve Herc Avery's fat butt off the top of his legs and feed it to the handiest pack of wolverines. It didn't make much Nevermind or Roy DePape one way or the other.
"Jonas also asked me to remind you it's early."
"Aye, we'll be there early," Avery agreed. "These two and six more good men. Fran Lengel's asked to go along, and he's got a machine gun."
Avery spoke this last with ringing pride, as if he himself had invented the machine gun. Then he looked at DePape slyly.
"What about you, Coffin Hand? Want to go along? Won't take me more than an eye blink to deputize you."
"I have another chore. Reynolds, too."
DePape smiled.
"There's plenty of work for all of us, Sheriff. After all, it's reaping."
11. That afternoon, Susan and Roland met at the hut in the Badgrass. She told him about the book with the torn-out pages, and Roland showed her what he'd left in the hut's north corner, secreted beneath a moldering pile of skins. She looked first at this, then at him, with wide and frightened eyes.
"What's wrong? What does he suspect is wrong?"
He shook his head. Nothing was wrong. Not that he could tell, anyway. And yet he had felt a strong need to do what he'd done, to leave what he'd left. It wasn't the touch, nothing like it, but only intuition. "I think everything is all right. Or as right as things can be, when the odds may turn out 50 of them for each of us. Susan, our only chance is to take them by surprise. You're not going to risk that, are you? Not planning to go to Lengel waving your father's stock line book around?" She shook her head. If Lengel had done what she now suspected, he'd get his payback 2 days from now. There would be reaping, all right, reaping aplenty. But this frightened her, and she said so. "Listen." Roland took her face in his hands and looked into her eyes. "I'm only trying to be careful. If things go badly, and they could, you're the one most likely to get away clean, you and Shimi. If that happens, Susan, you, thee, must come here and take my guns. Take them west, to Gilead. Find my father. He'll know thee are who thee says by what thee shows. Tell him what happened here, that's all."
"If anything happens to thee, Roland, I won't be able to do anything except die."
His hands were still on her face. Now he used them to make her head shake slowly from side to side. "You won't die," he said. There was a coldness in his voice and eyes that struck her not with fear, but awe. She thought of his blood, of how old it must be, and how cold it must sometimes flow. "Not with this job undone. Promise me."
I promise, Roland, I do."
"Tell me aloud what you promise."
"I'll come here, get your guns, take them to your dad, tell him what happened."
He nodded and let go of her face. The shapes of his hands were printed faintly on her cheeks.
"You frightened me,"
Susan said, and then shook her head. That wasn't right.
"You do frighten me."
"I can't help what I am."
"And I wouldn't change it."
She kissed his left cheek, his right cheek, his mouth. She put her hand inside his shirt and caressed his nipple. It grew instantly hard beneath the tip of her finger.
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," she said, now making soft butterfly kisses all over his face. Give your love her fondest wish.
After, they lay beneath a bearskin Roland had brought along and listened to the wind soft through the grass.
I love that sound, she said. It always makes me wish I could be part of the wind, go where it goes, see what it sees.
This year, if Ka allows, you will.
Aye, and with thee.
She turned to him up on one elbow. Light fell through the ruined roof and dappled her face.
Roland, I love thee.
She kissed him and then began to cry. He held her, concerned. What is it? Sue, what troubles thee?
I don't know,
she said, crying harder.
All I know is that there's a shadow on my heart.
She looked at him with tears still flowing from her eyes.
Thee had not leave me, would ye, dear? Thee had not go without Sue, would ye?
No.
For I've given all I have to ye, so I have, and my virginity's the very least of it, thee knows.
I'd never leave you. But he felt cold in spite of the bearskin, and the wind outside, so comforting a moment ago, sounded like beast's breath. Never, I swear.
I'm frightened, though. Indeed I am.
You needn't be, he said, speaking slowly and carefully, for suddenly all the wrong words wanted to come tumbling out of his mouth. We'll leave this, Susan, not day after tomorrow on reaping, but now, this minute. Dress, and we'll go crosswise to the wind. It's south we'll ride, and never look back. We'll be haunted. That's what they would be. Haunted by the faces of Elaine and Cuthbert. Haunted by the faces of all the men who might die in the Shaved Mountains. Massacred by weapons torn from the armory crypts where they should have been left. Haunted most of all by the faces of their fathers for all the rest of their lives. Not even the South Pole would be far enough to escape those faces. All you need do day after tomorrow is claim indisposition at lunch. They had gone over all this before, but now, in his sudden, pointless fright, it was all he could think of to say. Go to your room, then leave as you did on the night we met in the graveyard. Hide up a little, then when it's 3 o'clock, ride here and look under the skins in yon corner. If my guns are gone, and they will be, I swear they will, then everything's all right. You'll ride to meet us. Come to the place above the canyon, the one we told you of.
Well, I know all that, but something's wrong.
She looked at him. Touched the side of his face.
I fear for thee and me, Roland, and know not why.
All will work out, he said.
Ka, speak not to me of Ka, she cried. Oh, please don't. Ka, like a wind, my father said. It takes what it will, and minds the plea of no man or woman. Greedy old Ka, how I hate it.
Susan, no,
say no more.
She lay back and pushed the bearskin down to her knees, exposing a body that far greater men than Hart Thorin might have given away kingdoms for. Beads of sunlight ran over her bare skin like rain. She held her arms out to him. Never had she looked more beautiful to Roland than she did then, with her hair spread about her and that haunted look on her face. He would think later she knew. Some part of her knew.
No more talking, she said. Talking's done. If you love me, then love me.
And for the last time, Roland did. They rocked together, skin to skin and breath to breath. And outside, the wind roared into the west. Like a tidal wave. XII. That evening, as the grinning demon rose in the sky, Cordelia left her house and walked slowly across the lawn to her garden, detouring around the pile of leaves she had raked that afternoon. In her arms was a bundle of clothes. She dropped them in front of the pole to which her stuffy guy was bound, then looked raptly up at the rising moon. The knowing wink of the eye, the ghoul's grin, silver as bone was that moon, a white button against violet silk. It grinned at Cordelia. Cordelia grinned back. Finally, with the air of a woman awakening from a trance, she stepped forward and pulled the stuffy guy off its pole. His head lolled limply against her shoulder, like the head of a man who has found himself too drunk to dance. His red hands dangled. She stripped off the guy's clothes, uncovering a bulging, vaguely humanoid shape in a pair of her dead brother's long handles. She took one of the things she had brought from the house and held it up to the moonlight. A red silk riding shirt, one of Mayor Thorne's presents to Miss Oh So Young and Pretty. One of those she wouldn't wear. Whore's clothes, she had called them. And what did that make Cordelia Delgado, who had taken care of her even after her bull-headed dad decided he must stand against the likes of Fran Lengel and John Croydon? It made her a whorehouse madam, she supposed. This thought led to an image of Eldred Jonas and Coral Thorin naked and striving, while a honky-tonk piano planked out red dirt boogie below them, and Cordelia moaned like a dog. She yanked the silk shirt over the stuffy's head. Next came one of Susan's split riding skirts, after the skirt a pair of her slippers, and last, replacing the sombrero, one of Susan's spring bonnets. Presto, the stuffy guy was now a stuffy gal.
"And caught red-handed ye are," she whispered. "I know. Oh, yes, I know. I wasn't born yesterday."
She carried the stuffy from the garden to the pile of leaves on the lawn. She laid it close by the leaves, then scooped some up and pushed them into the bodice of the riding shirt, making rudimentary breasts. That done, she took a match from her pocket and struck it alight. The wind, as if eager to cooperate, dropped. Cordelia touched the match to the dry leaves. Soon the whole pile was blazing. She picked the stuffy gal up in her arms and stood with it in front of the fire. She didn't hear the rattling firecrackers from town, or the wheeze of the steam organ in Greenheart, or the mariachi band playing in the low market. When a burning leaf rose and swirled past her hair, threatening to set it alight, she didn't seem to notice. Her eyes were wide and blank. When the fire was at its height, she stepped to its edge and threw the stuffy on. Flame whumped up around it in bright orange gusts. Sparks and burning leaves swirled skyward in a funnel.
"So let it be done," Cordelia cried.
The firelight on her face turned her tears to blood.
"Char you tree, aye, just so."
The thing in the riding clothes caught fire, its face charring, its red hands blazing, its white cross eyes turning black. Its bonnet flared, the face began to burn. Cordelia stood and watched, fists clenching and unclenching, heedless of the sparks that lit on her skin, heedless of the blazing leaves that swirled toward the house. Had the house caught fire, she would likely have ignored that as well. She watched until the stuffy dressed in her niece's clothes was nothing but ashes lying atop more ashes. Then, as slowly as a robot with rust in its works, she walked back to the house, lay down on the sofa, and slept like the dead. XIII. It was 3:30 in the morning of the day before reaping, and Stanley Ruiz thought he was finally done for the night. The last music had quit 20 minutes ago, Sheb had outlasted the mariachis by an hour or so, and now lay snoring with his face in the sawdust. Cy Thorin was upstairs, and there had been no sign of the big coffin hunters. Stanley had an idea those were up to Seafront tonight. He also had an idea there was black work on offer, although he didn't know that for sure. He looked up at the glassy, two-headed gaze of the romp.
"Nor want to, old pal," he said. "All I want is about 9 hours of sleep. Tomorrow comes the real party, and they won't leave till dawn." So
a shrill scream rose from somewhere behind the building. Stanley jerked backward, thumping into the bar. Beside the piano, Sheb raised his head briefly, muttered, "What's that?" and dropped it back with a thump. Stanley had absolutely no urge to investigate the source of the scream. But he supposed he would just the same. It had sounded like that sad old bitch Petty the Trotter.
I'd like to trot your saggy old ass right out of town, he muttered, then bent down to look under the bar. There were two stout ashwood clubs here, the Calmer and the Killer. The Calmer was smooth, burled wood, guaranteed to put out the lights for 2 hours any time you tapped some boisterous cull's head in the right place with it. Stanley consulted his feelings and took the other club. It was shorter than the Calmer, wider at the top, and the business end of the Killer was studded with nails. Stanley went down to the end of the bar, through the door, and across a dim supply room stacked with barrels smelling of graff and whiskey. At the rear was a door giving on the backyard. Stanley approached it, took a deep breath, and unlocked it. He kept expecting Petty to voice another head-bursting scream, but none came. There was only the sound of the wind. Maybe he got lucky and she's killed, Stanley thought. He opened the door, stepping back and raising the nail-studded club at the same time. Petty wasn't killed. Dressed in a stained shift, a petty skirt, one might say, the whore was standing on the path which led to the back privy, her hands clutched together above the swell of her bosom and below the drooping turkey wattles of her neck. She was looking up at the sky.
"What is it?" Stanley asked, hurrying down to her. "Near scared 10 years off my life, ye did." "The moon, Stanley," she whispered. "Oh, look at the moon, would ye?"
He looked up, and what he saw set his heart thumping. But he tried to speak reasonably and calmly.
"Come now, Petty, it's dust. That's all. Now be reasonable, dear. You know how the wind's blown these last few days, and no rain to knock down what it carries. It's dust, that's all."
Yet it didn't look like dust.
"I know what I see," whispered Petty.
Above them, Demon Moon grinned and winked one eye through what appeared to be a shifting scrim of blood. Chapter 7 Taking the Ball 1 While a certain whore and certain bartender were still gaping up at the bloody moon, Kimba Reimer awoke, sneezing. "Damn, cold for reaping," he thought. "As much as I have to be out over the next 2 days, I'll be lucky if it doesn't turn into..." Something fluffed the end of his nose, and he sneezed again. Coming out of his narrow chest and dry slot of a mouth, it sounded like a small-caliber pistol shot in the black room. "Who's there?" he cried. No answer. Reimer suddenly imagined a bird, something nasty and bad-tempered, that had gotten in here in daylight and was now flying around in the dark, fluttering against his face as he slept. His skin crawled. Birds, bugs, bats, he hated them all, and he fumbled so energetically for the gas lamp on the table by his bed that he almost knocked it off onto the floor. As he drew it toward him, that flutter came again, this time puffing at his cheek. Reimer screamed and recoiled against the pillows, clutching the lamp to his chest. He turned the switch on the side, heard the hiss of gas, then pushed the spark. The lamp lit, and in the thin circle of its radiance he saw not a fluttering bird, but Clay Reynolds sitting on the edge of the bed. In one hand, Reynolds held the feather with which he had been tickling Magus's chancellor. His other was hidden in his cloak, which lay in his lap. Reynolds had disliked Reimer from their first meeting in the woods far west of town, those same woods beyond Eyebolt Canyon where Farson's man Letigo now quartered the main contingent of his troops. It had been a windy night, and as he and the other coffin hunters entered the little glade where Reimer, accompanied by Lengel and Croydon, were sitting by a small fire, Reynolds's cloak swirled around him. "Simonto," Reimer had said, and the other two had laughed. It had been meant as a harmless joke. But it hadn't seemed harmless to Reynolds. In many of the lands where he had traveled, manto meant not cloak, but leaner or bender. It was, in fact, a slang term for homosexual. That Reimer, a provincial man under his veneer of cynical sophistication, didn't know this, never crossed Reynolds's mind. He knew when people were making small of him, and if he could make such a person pay, he did so. For Kimba Reimer, payday had come.
"Reynolds, what are you doing?
How did you get in here?
You got to be thinking of their own cowboy, the man sitting on the bed replied. No Reynolds here, just Signor Manto.
He took out the hand which had been under his cloak. In it was a keenly honed cuchillo. Reynolds had purchased it in low market with this chore in mind. He raised it now and drove the 12-inch blade into Reimer's chest. It went all the way through, pinning him like a bug.
A bed bug, Reynolds thought.
The lamp fell out of Reimer's hands and rolled off the bed. It landed on the footrunner but did not break. On the far wall was Kimber Reimer's distorted, struggling shadow. The shadow of the other man bent over it like a hungry vulture. Reynolds lifted the hand which had held the knife. He turned it so the small blue tattooed coffin between thumb and forefinger was in front of Reimer's eyes. He wanted it to be the last thing Reimer saw on this side of the clearing.
"Let's hear you make fun of me now," Reynolds said.
He smiled.
"Come on, let's just hear you."
2. Shortly before 5 o'clock, Mayor Thorin woke from a terrible dream. In it, a bird with pink eyes had been cruising slowly back and forth above the barony. Wherever its shadow fell, the grass turned yellow, the leaves fell, shocked from the trees, and the crops died. The shadow was turning his green and pleasant barony into a wasteland.
"It may be my barony, but it's my bird, too," he thought just before awakening, huddled into a shuddery ball on one side of his bed. "My bird. I brought it here. I let it out of its cage."
There would be no more sleep for him this night, and Thorin knew it. He poured himself a glass of water, drank it, then walked into his study, absently picking his nightgown from the cleft of his bony old ass as he went. The puff on the end of his nightcap bobbed between his shoulder blades, his knees cracked at every step. As for the guilty feelings expressed by the dream, well, what was done was done. Jonas and his friends would have what they'd come for and paid so handsomely for in another day. A day after that, they'd be gone. Fly away, bird with the pink eyes and pestilent shadow. Fly away to wherever you came from and take the big coffin boys with you. He had an idea that by year's end he'd be too busy dipping his wick to think much about such things, or to dream such dreams. Besides, dreams without visible sign were just dreams, not omens. The visible sign might have been the boots beneath the study drapes, just the scuffed tips of them showing, but Thorin never looked in that direction. His eyes were fixed on the bottle beside his favorite chair. Drinking claret at 5 in the morning was no sort of habit to get into, but this once wouldn't hurt. He'd had a terrible dream, for God's sake. And after all, tomorrow's reaping, he said, sitting in the wing chair on the edge of the hearth. I guess a man can jump a fence or two come reap. He poured himself a drink, the last he'd ever take in this world, and coughed as the fire hit his belly and then climbed back up his throat, warming it. Better. Aye, much. No giant birds now, no plaguey shadows. He stretched out his arms, laced his long and bony fingers together, and cracked them viciously.
"I hate it when you do that, you scrawny git,"
spoke a voice directly into Thorin's left ear. Thorin jumped. His heart took its own tremendous leap in his chest. The empty glass flew from his hand, and there was no footrunner to cushion its landing. It smashed on the hearth. Before Thorin could scream, Roy de Pape brushed off the mayoral nightcap, seized the gauzy remains of the mayoral mane, and yanked the mayoral head back. The knife de Pape held in his other hand was much humbler than the one Reynolds had used, but it cut the old man's throat efficiently enough. Blood sprayed scarlet in the dim room. De Pape let go of Thorin's hair, went back to the drapes he had been hiding behind, and picked something up off the floor. It was Cuthbert's lookout. De Pape brought it back to the chair and put it in the dying mayor's lap.
"Brr,"
Thorin gargled through a mouthful of blood.
"Bird."
"Yar, old fella, and Trigger, you'd notice at a time like this, I will say."
DePape pulled Thorin's head back again and took the old man's eyes out with two quick flips of his knife. One went into the dead fireplace, the other hit the wall and slid down behind the fire tools. Thorin's right foot trembled briefly and was still. One more job to do. DePape looked around, saw Thorin's nightcap, and decided the ball on the end would serve. He picked it up, dipped it in the puddle of blood in the mayor's lap, and drew the good man's sigil on the wall.
"There," he murmured, standing back. "If that don't finish him, nothing on earth will."
True enough. The only question left unanswered was whether or not Roland's quartet could be taken alive. 3. Jonas had told Fran Lengel exactly where to place his men. 2 inside the stable and 6 more out. 3 of these latter gents hidden behind rusty old implements, 2 hidden in the burnt-out remains of the home place, 1, Dave Hollis, crouched on top of the stable itself, spying over the roof peak. Lengel was glad to see that the men in the posse took their job seriously. They were only boys, it was true, but boys who had on one occasion come off ahead of the big coffin hunters. Sheriff Avery gave a fair impression of being in charge of things until they got within a good shot of the Bar K. Then Lengel, machine gun slung over one shoulder and as straight-backed in the saddle as he had been at 20, took command. Avery, who looked nervous and sounded out of breath, seemed relieved rather than offended.
"I'll tell ye where to go, as was told to me, for it's a good plan and I have no quarrel with it," Lengel had told his posse.
In the dark, their faces were little more than dim blurs.
"Only one thing I'll say to ye on my own hook. We don't need 'em alive, but it's best we have 'em so. It's the barony we want to put paid to 'em, the common folk, and so put paid to this whole business as well. Shut the door on it, if you will. So I say this, if there's cause to shoot, shoot. But I'll flay the skin off the face of any man who shoots without cause. Do you understand?"
No response. It seemed they did.
"All right," Lengel had said. His face was stony. "I give you a minute to make sure your gear's muffled, and then on we go. Not another word from here on out."
4. Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain came out of the bunkhouse at 6:15 that morning and stood a row on the porch. Alain was finishing his coffee. Cuthbert was yawning and stretching. Roland was buttoning his shirt and looking southwest toward the bad grass. He was thinking not of ambushes, but of Susan. Her tears.
"Greedy old car, how I hate it," she had said.
His instincts did not awake. Alain's touch, which had sensed Jonas on the day Jonas had killed the pigeons, did not so much as quiver. As for Cuthbert, "One more day of quiet," that worthy exclaimed to the dawning sky.
"One more day of grace. One more day of silence, broken only by the lover's sigh and the tattoo of horses' hoofs."
"One more day of your bullshit," Alain said. "Come on." They set off across the dooryard, sensing the 8 pairs of eyes on them not at all. They walked into the stable, past the 2 men flanking the door, one hidden behind an ancient harrow, the other tucked behind an untidy stack of hay, both with guns drawn. Only Rusher sensed something was wrong. He stamped his feet, rolled his eyes, and as Roland backed him out of his stall, tried to rear.
"Hey, boy," he said, and looked around.
"Spiders, I reckon. He hates them."
Outside, Lengel stood up and waved both hands forward. Men moved silently toward the front of the stable. On the roof, Dave Hollis stood with his gun drawn. His monocle was tucked away in his vest pocket so it should blink no badly timed reflection. Cuthbert led his mount out of the stable. Alain followed. Roland came last, short leading the nervous, prancy gelding.
"Look," Cuthbert said cheerily, still unaware of the men standing directly behind him and his friends.
He was pointing north. "A cloud in the shape of a bear. Good luck for..."
"Don't move, cullies," Fran Lengel called. "Don't so much as shuffle your god-pounding feet."
Alain did begin to turn, in startlement more than anything else, and there was a ripple of small clicking sounds, like many dry twigs all snapping at once. the sound of cocking pistols and musketoons.
"No, Al," Roland said. "Don't move. Don't."
In his throat, despair rose like poison, and tears of rage stung at the corners of his eyes, yet he stood quiet. Cuthbert and Alain must stand quiet, too. If they moved, they'd be killed.
"Don't move," he called again, "either of you."
"Wise, Cully."
Lengel's voice was closer now, and accompanied by several pairs of footfalls.
"Put your hands behind ye."
Two shadows flanked Roland, long in the first light. Judging by the bulk of the one on his left, he guessed it was being thrown by Sheriff Avery. He probably wouldn't be offering them any white tea this day. Lengel would belong to the other shadow.
"Hurry up, Dearborn, or whatever your name may be. Get him behind ye, smaller your back. There's guns pointed at your pards, and if we end up taking in only two of you instead of three, life will go on."
Not taking any chances with us, Roland thought, and felt a moment of perverse pride. With it came a taste of something that was almost amusement. Bitter, though. That taste continued very bitter.
"Roland!"
It was Cuthbert, and there was agony in his voice.
"Roland, don't!"
But there was no choice. Roland put his hands behind his back. Rusher uttered a small reproving whinny, as if to say all this was highly improper, and trotted away to stand beside the bunkhouse porch.
"You're going to feel metal on your wrists," Lengel said. "Esposas."
Two cold circles slipped over Roland's hands. There was a click, and suddenly the arcs of the handcuffs were tight against his wrists.
"All right," said another voice. "Now you, son."
"Be damned if I will!"
Cuthbert's voice wavered on the edge of hysteria. There was a thud and a muffled cry of pain. Roland turned around and saw Alain down on one knee, the heel of his left hand pressed against his forehead. Blood ran down his face.
"You want me to deal him another'n?"
Jake White asked. He had an old pistol in his hand, reversed so the butt was forward.
"I can, you know. My arm is feeling very limber for this early in the day."
"No!"
Cuthbert was twitching with horror and something like grief. Ranged behind him were three armed men looking on with nervous avidity.
"Then be a good boy and get your hands behind you."